This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
All righty, welcome to episode 15 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and this week we have Kevin Clancy, better known as KFC from Barstool, joining us, and with the sort of surprising news that Dave Portnoy has reacquired the company from Penn Entertainment last week, I thought it was a good time to get somebody from Barstool on the podcast. Kevin, thanks for joining us today. When did you find out that Portnoy was buying the company back from Penn for $1? And how surprised were you that it was happening?
I'm not on the gambling side of things at Barstool, doing comedy and entertainment. So the entire Penn deal and Penn existence was kind of, you know, outside of my realm. And I usually, you know, those guys were doing their gambling thing and it was good for all of us, but I never was in on like the day to day and ins and outs. I was much more involved the first time around with Chernin and the entertainment side, but the gambling stuff was never really my forte. So, I was kind of finding out, you know, almost everything in real time as well. I was not, you know, involved in any of the business dealings. So I just kind of found out the whole thing all at once. And, I mean, it's unbelievable. It's an episode of Succession mixed with an episode of Entourage mixed with, you know, it's going to make a great movie one day.
Yeah, I'm sure it also gives Dave a much needed ego boost as well.
Yeah, you know, if there's one guy who I think needs a little more self-confidence, it's Dave Portnoy. So I'm just happy for him that, you know, he can feel good about himself at the end of the day.
You mentioned obviously that you weren't really on the gambling side of things with Barstool. Were you ever concerned that Barstool was kind of moving on without you because of the focus on sports betting in recent years? It seemed like most of the content went in that direction. You and maybe Kirk Minahan were like the two biggest outliers there.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would, I actually can't say it. I can't call it. I think I would always have a place at Barstool if Dave was, you know, heavily involved and was still there and running things. If it was up to Penn, you know, in the hands of Penn and Penn only, I think everybody here used to think, I don't gamble. I don't bring in gambling dollars. That can't be great. You know, they were Penn Entertainment. They changed their name, I believe. Right. And there was always a vote of confidence. The one thing we didn't want to do is like fake gambling. And I was on board with that. I was like, I'm not going to all of a sudden pretend that I'm, you know, betting and be something I'm not. I'd rather try to make my own avenue and be like, you know, if you need, I'll do like a live comedy show at one of your casinos, or people who like comedy also do like gambling, so we can advertise. And, you know, there's ways around it without being a intimate gambler yourself. But yeah, I mean, there was always like the feeling of the writing on the wall of like, I'm a entertainment podcaster at a gambling company. That doesn't really bode well for anybody. But before I ever really had to worry about it, before like contracts or anything came up, this happened. So, like Kanye said, I guess we'll never know.
How is Barstool's relationship with Penn from your perspective? Were things different the last couple of years as far as you noticed?
I never changed anything. Now, again, I don't do gambling content. So if you are on a gambling stream representing Penn and representing sponsors, you can't say certain things because of government regulations and rules. I don't do that stuff, though. So I was, you know, off in my comedy world. And I think two things helped me. I think one, not being directly tied to any sort of gambling dollars or regulations during my content. And two, I don't know necessarily if they were, you know, paying attention to every single thing I ever said, because, you know, again, I wasn't one of their gambling people. So me personally, I never changed the topic. I never changed language, never pulled punches. Now the rest of the world has kind of changed and evolved. And there are just generally things that I'm like, maybe 10 years ago, I would have talked about that on the podcast, but I'm not going to do that today. That was never a Penn thing. That was more of just the world. But I never once heard anything bad from Penn. I never had Penn reach out and say, stop this. It was all pretty good.
Just a few months ago, Dave had told Kirk Minahan that his contract with Penn was going to expire in 20 months and wasn't sure about an extension. And obviously that's a bit of a moot point now, but could you have foreseen Barstool existing without Dave as a part of the brand?
Yeah, I think we reached a point where we would take a hit. I mean, you're losing, in my opinion, the number one guy in media and maybe, you know, the best. We would take a hit. I think he's one of the best to ever do it. Maybe the best to ever blog and podcast and do video and all that. But if you asked me that question the first time around, like when we were dealing with Chernin, I would probably have said no. By this point, pardon my take, Foreplay, Spittin' Chiclets, $1 million worth of game, Brianna Chicken Fry, what we did with Call Her Daddy and Alex Cooper, we not only have like made stars and then sent them off on their way, we've also retained stars. We've got everything ranging from, you know, like mega brands that everybody knows down to niche shows, new shows that are growing. You know, to be honest, like KFC Radio always operated without Dave in a way. Like he was never making any appearances. He never really promoted. He kind of like wanted us to stand on our own too. So for years now, it's been, you know, would the company, like would the revenue drop to the point that we couldn't pay everybody, things like that of that nature. There was probably a point where that was the case. But it never really was like Dave is the one doing all of the content. He's very good about like, it's very sink or swim. You don't give you a script. They just kind of hire you and throw you into the deep end. And you got to just like figure things out yourself. And I think everybody's done a good job of building their own brands, whether it's, you know, multi-million or just, you know, bringing in some dollars to cover your salary, whatever it is, all of those shows really do find a way to live on their own. And I think we reached a point where all of those have existed for many years without the interaction or any sort of involvement with Dave. So I think we finally did reach a point that we could have existed without him, but it would have never been the same. I'm sure a lot of Boston people, the original fans and like the original diehards would have fallen off. But again, luckily we're not going to have to go down that road. We don't know.
How has the outside reaction been to the news that Portnoy reacquired ownership of the company, just from like your fans and followers in that standpoint?
I actually said, I feel like I turned back into a fan because when I first found Barstool, I was working in the corporate world myself.
Right.
And a coworker of mine just showed me all the different blogs to kill time when you're just miserable at work. Barstool was one of them. So before I worked for him, I was, you know, following along. I knew all the writers. I knew all the inside jokes and ins and outs. And for that day, I was like, it was like, I didn't even work here. I was just like, we're fucking back as, you know, a stoolie as a fan. And then to watch all the messages, DMs, and like, and even just, you know, people in my real life, the amount of people who DM'd me or messaged me being like, dude, I'm like 41 years old. I've got, you know, a family and kids. I've been pretty removed from any sort of entertainment involvement in years. But like, goddamn, if this isn't the greatest reality show I've ever seen, like I was fist pumping when I heard the news, I was calling my friends. It's like when a band you love that broke up, got back together. It's like your favorite TV show that got canceled coming back to Netflix. Like it, the amount of the outpouring of people who were like, holy shit. And to be honest, I genuinely mean, I don't think Penn like censored or changed it, but there's just this feel of like, we're doing it for ourselves again. So even if it doesn't literally change that like figurative feeling of like, it's just back to the boys and the pirate ship is, it was awesome. It was like the whole vibe here has been different. Everyone's kind of like reinvigorated.
I think it's interesting because I guess just the way the algorithms are and the people that I follow on social media, I've seen reaction that has been more like head shaking and concern. Like is 2023 really ready for an unregulated Barstool Sports? So how much of the touting that the pirate ship is back is just shtick? And how much of it is like, no, like you guys really want to take the brand to another level of brashness and polarization?
Well, here's the thing. We never, like, Barstool never has been out to polarize. We've never been out, like, our intention was never like, let's go out there and push the envelope. Let's be edgy. Now, many times our jokes, our takes, our content has ended up rubbing some people the wrong way, offending some people. But I think the reason why we work is because we're not doing that on purpose. I think everyone at this point has been on the internet and social media long enough that you can see right through the people who are like, I'm just here to say inflammatory shit and just be reckless. And I want to get, you know, I want people grasping their pearls, and that's how I'm going to get my attention. We are like, I either genuinely believe this or I thought that was funny. And there's been times where we've been wrong, been times where we've like, you know, gone too far. But it's never been, you know, that's never the intent. So it wasn't like when Dave got the company back, like, let's go rogue and let's, you know,
yeah,
like we're, the Renegades are back. It's more just like, you know, job security, and people are just like happy to be working for someone they know again. Like I said, like my show's not going to change. I think just like the aura and the vibe around everything is kind of different, but it's not like, oh, I can say this again and do this again. And this show that I put on hiatus is coming back, and this video we can do now. So I don't think it's a very literal change. Dave, you know, on our show the other day on the rundown, Dave was saying like, I need to learn the rules of society right now. Like, it's not about gambling regulations anymore. It's about like, what do people like and what do they consume?
Right.
And that, so we're going to have to find, you know, where we fall in there. But as always, man, the Barstool reputation was always way kind of warped. Like, we were not like the frat bros. We're not like, we're all kind of like internet nerds at the end of the day. We're all bloggers. We're not, you know, like it's always kind of been a little mischaracterized. So then and now, I don't think we're like the bad boys. We joke around that way, but I don't really think that's the case.
The sale back to Portnoy, that didn't affect you getting your money from the sale to Penn, correct? Because I know you just recently got paid for that sale earlier this year.
Yeah. Yeah. That thankfully didn't affect anything for me.
What did your future with Barstool look like before Portnoy bought it back? Was there ever a thought that, like, now that I got my money from the sale, I've been here long enough, maybe it's time to go do something else?
Yeah, I mean, I always, and still to this day, think about, like, doing things solo. But once Dave kind of bought it back, it was more like, you know, he said something to me like, well, I'm not selling this again, and we can just do this for the rest of our lives. And he was just like, you know, earn money, pay for, you know, your team around you, like make a profit, do your thing. I'll leave you alone. And like, you can just do this. I think in his announcement, he said, I'm going to own this until I die. And when I die, I'll give it to Kevin. And when he dies, he can give it to his kids, which is like, I think the first time Dave's ever said something nice about my kids. So, that is a cool feeling that I don't take for granted. I don't think there's many people out there that can say like with certainty, I'm going to like the job I'm working, the career I'm doing, I have this like secured for the rest of my life. Now anything can happen, but the fact that that's kind of the messaging and Dave is like, that's the early, vibe he's put out there. That's pretty awesome to know that. And like I said, I've already kind of KFC Radio is my podcast, and a couple other things I do is already kind of like insulated and doing its thing. So it's not like, if I stay with Barstool, I have to do this, that, and the other thing that I don't want to do. I've already been operating the way I want to. Now I just kind of know that, you know, the paycheck will be there and the support will be there and the company will be there forever. So even before my contract expired and I really ever had to give some serious thought to like, should I stay, should I go? The question was already answered for me.
You talked about this a little bit, but how has the line changed for you since joining Barstool on what things you say or tweet that can just be brushed off as comedy and what has to be recognized as like, no, this is potentially going to unfairly offend a group of people. And that's not necessarily anything to do with Penn, but more so just about the world changing.
Yeah. I mean, anything political got, you know, became radioactive, where in the past, I think I would have, you know, chimed in on candidates more and even things that are like funny, non-political things, but just happen in the political realm. It's just like not worth it. It's not even necessarily which topics. It's more like I've been doing it for so long. In the early years, when I hadn't necessarily gotten all my opinions and all my thoughts and all my jokes off, If there was a new topic, a new video, a new person, I was like, I want to speak my piece on them. Now I'm like, I mean, I've been doing it for like 15 years. I've been doing the podcast for 10. I've probably written tens of thousands of blogs. I've been on thousands of episodes. I've done hundreds of videos. I'm like, I said my piece. People know, you know, where I stand, how funny I am, how funny I'm not, how successful I am, how successful I'm not. So like, I am where I am. So when there's something that potentially could harm the company, harm my family, or harm someone else, it's just not necessarily worth like one more laugh or one more follower or one more retweet. So it's always kind of just like a analysis of like, is the juice worth the squeeze? And I'm still a slave to the joke and the content. Like a lot of times I still will side on, I'll err on the side of like, I'm going to say it. But, you know, there are definitely times where it's just like, if that's just a tweet that you're throwing out there in the middle of the night, what's the upside? You get a couple hundred retweets and maybe a few new followers. What does that do for you? And the downside is not only bad for business, but also, you know, you're going to offend some people. You're going to hurt some feelings. You're going to, you know, I'm beyond that point in my career where I can just be like, fuck your feelings. I'm going to say whatever I want, whenever I want. So, it's always, you know, whether it's Penn, whether it's Dave, whether it's me alone, whatever, that's always kind of a balancing act I'm doing in my head.
Do you find that you have to kind of like gut check yourself more, or are you very comfortable being unfiltered and open?
Yeah. I mean, at this point, like I've always felt, I've never been like, oh shit, we're live, or like, oh, I'm talking to someone else and I don't have control of the edit. Like, watch what you say and do.
Right.
Now, there has been times where I've like, you know, in a conversation, joking around about something, like gone too far, upset some people. So, you know, many years ago, maybe kind of my radar was off a little bit, or, you know, my barometer of what flies was maybe a little too liberal, whatever. I'm at the point now where I'm pretty sure I know where that is. And I'm also comfortable with like, if someone is upset, I can generally feel like that's a more of them being sensitive than me being insensitive sort of thing. Like I'm at the point now where my humor and my thoughts are not that crazy. It's not, you know, nothing I'm saying is, I'm not like perpetuating crazy conspiracy theories. I'm not, you know, it's not Alex Jones. It's not InfoWars. It's not Meet Milo. We're just regular guys talking about regular things. So of course we'll like ruffle some feathers, but I don't think there's anything we do now that's like, watch out for that, you know.
What about people that bring up old tweets that you had that were deemed racially insensitive and things like that? And first of all, why haven't you deleted those tweets? And then second of all, does it bother you when you see those getting brought back up as often as they do? I feel like I see it every few months or so.
There has been some that I've deleted. If there are some that are still up, it's usually because, you know, okay. I kind of stand by, not stand by the joke, but stand by like the screenshots are there. People know the things that I said. I'm not necessarily trying to hide it because I do genuinely believe that like the intent matters. And context matters too. Like the time of the era that we were in and the time that we were saying it, what was going on in that moment, who I was talking to or why I was saying it. You know, there are some things that just on its own sound absolutely ridiculous. And then if you know that, oh, that was a callback to this thing that guy said, you know, all those things that are like, I understand that it upsets you, but I think that I have a long track record of showing what my true colors are and like what my intention is, what I'm trying to do here. And it's never been anything. I've never had any like ill will. It's never, you know, I don't mean anything malicious. And I think there's a lot of stuff on the other side to prove that. I always feel like when I get shit from both sides is when I feel like I'm doing a good job. And I pretty much have always got that my whole life. There are people who call me, you know, a liberal soy boy. And then there are people who call me a crazy misogynist. And I'm like, it's probably because both of those times I said those things, I was being extreme or hyperbolic or just trying to be funny. And the reality is I'm right in the middle with like, I don't know, the vast majority of people I believe in the world today. So
were you always comfortable being so transparent and even talking about your personal life to an audience, whether that's marital problems that landed on Page Six or responding to backlash after saying something controversial. Have you always been that transparent throughout your life?
Nothing I've done with my career has ever been like intentional. I never planned to do this. I did radio at Fordham for a little bit, where I wanted to, like, you know, maybe my dream was to be like a Sports Center anchor, like cover media that way. And, but it was never like, I want to be a comic or a podcaster or any of that. It just kind of ended up falling in my lap. And then when Barstool fell in my lap, I was just like, I just want to succeed. I just want to grow it. I want to make money. I want to be, you know, I want a lot of clicks and views and readers. And the way that came naturally to me was being honest. And when you're, you know, 25, 24, 25, 26, 27, you're a single guy, you're just telling stories about dating, going out, living with your buddies, partying. There's not that much to, you know, really worry about. And so I kind of, my persona was one of like, I think I succeed on relatability. And when, you know, I would speak my truth, or that sounds kind of corny, but when I speak the truth, a lot of people would be like, oh, I agree with that. Or like, oh, I lived the same life as you. I had the same upbringing as you, and they could relate to me. So for me, it was like, oh, this is what I do. Like, some people have a character they play. Some people do satire. Some people, you know, whatever they do. My thing is like truly the Barstool message of like, I'm the average common man. So I'm putting my life out there, and a lot of people are going, holy shit, I do the same thing, say the same thing, act the same way. So let me follow this guy. Now, when you get older and you mature a little bit, now all of a sudden you have a wife and you have kids and life gets a little more difficult and life gets harder. You know, yes, there are definitely times where I was like, shit, I wish I hadn't put my whole life out there, because now they know my life. And when my life changes, I have to address it, and everything became public. But you can't put that toothpaste back in the tube. So for better or worse, I've always just been brutally honest. That's kind of always been the tagline or the hook, is like, you get a completely unfiltered access to like an average guy's mind. The marriage situation was unfortunate, but I had to go through it, and it played out publicly. So I was just like, this is where my life's going. It's almost like a reality show in that sense. If I could do it all over again, I wish it wasn't. I would probably have been more protective and not shown my kids and talked about it going, like, since then going forward. I do keep like a portion of my life private, but you know, can't do anything about it now.
Yeah. And I think about just in general, radio stations, TV stations, most media outlets, the amount of places where if an employee has some sort of personal issue, management's first thought is bury it, ignore it, even though it might be a news story elsewhere. Would that be easier to go that route, or is it easier to just, like, if other people are talking about it in a controversial manner or something, that you want to be upfront about it as well?
I think I probably took it to an extreme. Like, I was on radio, like, I didn't miss a day. That was probably pretty silly. Like, I was very adamant that I was like, I've always been honest and I've always been real. And I've talked about other people and their personal lives. And now I'm the one in the hot seat, and it would be pretty disingenuous of me to like hide. So I'm going to face the fire, face the music. I probably could have taken a day or a week to just gather myself and figure things out. I think had I not done it the way I did, I think I could have, you know, like, lost my career as well. Like, my personal life blew up, and there are definitely mistakes that I made in my personal life that I wish I didn't make, but I think I handled it pretty well professionally. And a lot of people I hear from are always like, you know, I don't know you and I don't know your business, but I thought, you know, you conducted yourself well. That's all I can really hope for. So I could have been different. Maybe would I have done it differently? Will I do it differently if something else happens again? Probably a little different, but to me, if you're going to like run and hide, you should just like run away, like check out of the life. You know what I mean? But if you're going to do this and do it the way I do it, when times are good, you know, of course it's easy to be out there and showing how everything's great and being in everyone else's business. But when the tables are turned, if you don't, you know, accept that same fate, that's kind of bullshit. So
I mentioned concern from non-stoolies about like how many more limits can Barstool try to push in 2023. But what about for the company's employees where everything is expected to be turned into content? Is there ever or was there ever a time that you kind of wanted to hide behind something and just be like, nope, I can't talk about this because Penn won't let me?
Oh, never because the Penn won't let me. But there was just times like during that whole thing, I remember stepping off the elevator and there was a camera in my face right away. And for, you know, whatever reason, I just wasn't prepared for that. I was like, oh, shit, that's right. This is, you know, going to be big time content. I think everybody has gone through something here personal where they wish that, you know, they could just go through it privately and handle it. And that's kind of the trade off of, you know, you get to live this pretty good life, a lot of opportunities. You're doing something you love. You're not rotting away at a desk. You're not just working as a corporate cube monkey. And then in exchange, you know, sometimes your shit's put on blast. And it also usually like if that's really not for you and you can't handle that, like usually that's kind of the reality check and people move on or they go find a different role or a job or whatever. And the people who can handle it or don't mind it are, you know, they keep going.
As much as Barstool and its rabid fan base gets criticized, especially the way they kind of attack and support Dave every time there's a bad headline written about him or anything like that, I think it would also be unfair not to at least note the charity work that you guys do. And I don't know where Barstool ranks in terms of money raised and donated against other companies, but like, I'm not just talking about a news network that donates millions to the Met Gala or something like that. Like this person could use some help. Let's get them some money tomorrow. I've seen it happen personally up close with one of my best friends who had cancer, so I could vouch for it. But from your perspective, I guess, first of all, how crazy are stoolies? And then second of all, how important are they to Barstool's success?
I mean, you could argue they are like the sole reason for the success. You know, like it started in Boston where, you know, such a town of like chip on your shoulder. And from like a sports point of view, it was like us against the world sort of thing. But then that became, you know, that translates into other ways that are much more important than just like sports fandom. You know, the marathon bombing was a huge issue and like the whole city rallied together. And then it went from Boston to the Northeast and then from the Northeast to like the whole country. And so whether it's like an individual, like you said, who were, you know, raising a few thousand bucks and just trying to put a smile on their face if they're, you know, going through a terminal illness, or it's something like the Barstool Fund trying to prop up, you know, companies across the entire country during a global pandemic, or I have a plaque here. It's probably my most important thing that's in the office is when we raise money for Michael Davidson, who's FDNY officer who died in 2018. And we raised, I think, like $150,000 for his wife and kids in their house. We raised money when the police officers were gunned down in Jersey City. And then just like little things along the way here and there where it's like you find a good cause and you're like, hey, Stoolies, donate to my Venmo and I'll send over. And by the end of the night, it's like $2,500 and it's nothing crazy, but it's like, I don't know, that paid that person's rent or their medical bills or whatever it is. We've, you know, adopting dogs and horses and animals and you know, there's an endless line of things that we've done good for good that never gets brought up. And that's, yeah. And that's life. It's like people are going to harp on your negative stuff and the positive stuff gets brushed under the rug. But also that's not really why we do it. We're not doing it for PR, because if we were, we would have stopped doing it because we don't get the PR. Nobody ever mentions it, but yet we're still doing it because it's, you know, I grew up with firefighters and policemen. It's very near and dear to me. And when a guy from Boston, you know, loses a limb in a terrorist bombing, Dave wanted to help him. And Dave loves, you know, small restaurants and businesses, so he wanted to help them during the pandemic. It's all usually like a personal connection. My co-host Feidelberg works for Team Impact up in Massachusetts, and he's always going to their galas and like hanging out with kids who are looking to get into college sports and whatnot. The list goes on and on. The ZBT is our military blog. We have three veterans who are, you know, always helping out the military community. And, you know, of course that never gets mentioned, but whatever. We the people who we help the most, they're the ones who recognize it and know, and that's really what matters.
Are the original fans still around, or does Barstool's audience, does it outgrow Barstool over time? Like who do you envision yourself talking to when you're creating content? Are you now a bunch of older people talking to a younger audience?
I think I've aged well. I think I've aged appropriately. You know, when I first had a kid, I started a show called Podfathers, which I then kind of passed the torch to other dads because I was the first guy at Barstool to have kids. And it was like, this is a whole new frontier. And I want to tackle having a child the same way I tackle sports and content and all that. So I've always kind of aged. Like I said, I just talked about my life. So whatever's going on in my life at that time is going to be what my listeners are going through. And they kind of age with me and continue to listen. Now, naturally, you just have less time to sit around and watch videos and read blogs and listen to podcasts. I still think I have a heavy, like, similar age demo to me. And I think, you know, I think something like 40% of my listeners have, like, a family, and, you know, 50% are, like, making a career earning type money. And then there's, you know, the outliers on either side. Now, I think there's other shows with people who, like, you know, Dave is older than me, but he's doing the BFFs pod with a, you know, 21-year-old kid. He has 15-year-olds who know who he is. Yeah. I probably have a lot less of that, but I think we all kind of balance out. It's not really about age as much as it's about lifestyle. You know, if you're 27, but you have a wife and kids or a husband and kids, you're going to relate much more to that lifestyle than if you're a 45-year-old bachelor. So,
right.
I think we do a pretty good job of, like, both. But it's pretty important. Like, self-awareness is my number one thing. So I hope I'm never the guy who's like, you know, hey, dude, grow up, you know, you're 40. I think I've, you know, I'm not partying anymore. I don't talk about some of the same things I used to talk about because I'm not doing them anymore. It's not like, yeah. It's not like I'm like, oh, I can't talk about that anymore. It's like, I don't do it anymore. I don't live it. So it's just whatever comes naturally in my life is kind of the next level of content for me.
You've done radio, podcasting, blogging, social media content, things like One Minute Man. What type of content do Barstool fans mostly associate you with?
Oh, that's a good question. One Minute Man was the first thing that ever I had a different reputation. Like, I would be in the street and someone would be like, that's the One Minute Man. And for my whole career prior to that, it would be, oh, that's KFC. You know, so people who knew me just knew me as KFC or Kevin. And then it's like, oh, you're that, oh, you're from Instagram, right? You're, you know, not even knowing that I have a whole podcast for a decade, right. I've written all these blogs. I mean, I think to this day, my best talent is blogging. And I think, like, all the diehard fans, if you were to say, like, what is he best at or what did I like most about him was blogging. I think a lot of people associate podcasting with me because I was the one who started it here. And I, like, put all my eggs in the podcasting basket and was like, I really think this is where the world is going. And I think that proved obviously to be true. So honestly, it's like, but I think old school people know me and think I'm best at blogging. A lot of people at the company think of me as podcasting, but then my biggest audience is probably the social media videos. So in a weird way, you can make the case for all three. I can't, I don't know. It's one of those, it's, you know, depending on where you are in that trio right there.
Would you like Barstool to get back on Sirius?
No. Well, I'm down for whatever. I think, you know, video and YouTube is more the future. I think Sirius was great for us, though. Like, when we had a Sirius lineup, we were there was a whole world of people that, like, you could just listen to Sirius through the whole day and you would be caught up on everything at Barstool. And when that went away, it was like, now you have to, like, read this blog, download this podcast, watch this video, and, you know, learn who these people are. And it's like, you kind of have to seek it out yourself, whereas Sirius kind of presented it to us. I think that there's certainly a world where Sirius and Barstool can help each other and work together, but I also don't think it's, like, necessary. So it kind of can go either direction for me on that one.
What did you go to Fordham for? I know you ended up being an accountant. Is that why you went to Fordham, or did you originally have aspirations of broadcast journalism? Did you go? Did you?
No. So,
you mentioned you did radio there.
Yeah, I went to Fordham. My brother went to Fordham. I applied to a few schools. I didn't really get into the ones I wanted to. So then it was kind of like, well, where do I go next? I've always been a New York guy. I was born in the Bronx. Figured give that a shot. Then when I was there, I was just kind of like going through the college experience. Like I was like, I'll just be in the business school, keep it general. While I was there, I got ahead on some credits. I took some summer classes. I had a bunch of APs. I did pretty well in school. So I was a semester ahead. So I was graduating early and they offered me their 5-year MBA program. So because I was ahead and they do the 5-year program, I was almost able, rather than graduate in May as a regular 4-year senior would, I was able to graduate in August of that same year with my MBA. So I was like, I guess I'll just go down the business road. I can do this thing here, save some money, and save a lot of time and get my MBA. And hopefully that just means a higher salary and some more opportunities in the business world. All my friends are like in finance and hedge funds and all that shit. And they loved that. So I just kind of fell in line with them. Deloitte just like fell in my lap. I honestly think it was like, you know, one of those websites that's like a headhunter thing, just fell in my lap. Worked there because it was like, you know, good salary and a good benefits package. And then the Barstool thing fell into my lap when I was blogging for fun personally, just to like have a creative outlet. And it fell into my lap. The broadcasting thing I did sophomore year, I was like, I got to get involved and do more than just like party and booze and stuff. So I went to the radio. If you're not familiar, WFUV is like, I think in my opinion, the number one, you know.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal.
Or Pepperdine or whatever. But I think WFUV is like the number one sports broadcasting school in the country. So I did that for a while. I covered the Cyclones and the Staten Island Yankees. I did I hosted their show one-on-one a couple times. I did some beat reporter work, all that sort of stuff. But to be honest, it was just like so little pay. And there was so much, you know, you could work at this for 25 years before you ever, you know, sniff a dollar or any time on the mic or anything. And I just, you know, I didn't love it that much. So I went down the finance route. But it was funny because it was all of a sudden, it was like Mr. Miyagi and the Karate Kid. Like all of a sudden I was like, wait a minute, I've actually been kind of honing those skills when I didn't even realize it. Because there's a lot of things at Barstool with podcasting and One Minute Man and stuff that's like, you know, somewhere deep in my mind way back when I was learning some of those skills pretty early on. So I never intended it, but I think actually, and then when I left it, I figured I'm leaving that in the past. But then it all kind of came back around to make it corny.
Did you do stuff at WFUV that with anybody that's now working in the industry?
I was with Nick Costos. Mike Gunzelman. Mm-hmm. We had a good crop of kids. I feel like there's been people who have popped in and out. Kenny Porden was there. I don't know if he ever, but you know, the alumni list is crazy there.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I remember I'm pretty sure I like interviewed Ryan Ruco.
He
was coming in after me and he was hyped up. Like Bob Aarons was like, this kid is the goods. He is the next, you know, Spiro. He's the next Mike Breen. And he was like, go talk to him for a minute, like while, like before his interview starts, like, you know, I need you to buy me like 5 minutes. So I like went and asked him some questions. But I remember, you know, Bob being like, this kid is the real deal. And then like 2 minutes later, he was the Yankees, you know.
Yeah. It's pretty good forecast. It's worked out pretty well for him.
Big time. So, yeah, I mean, I was surrounded by really, really quality talent that like, whether or not I even realized it, I was, you know, probably soaking it up.
What'd you think of Pat McAfee when he was working at Barstool?
Bro, I've always said Pat is, I think, the biggest star like in the industry. I think he's got it, man. He's got that. I'm a big wrestling fan, or I was. I kind of fell off as an adult, but I do often view things through the lens of the WWF, WWE, and obviously he literally does that. But even before he had worked with them, he was a wrestler. He was a personality. He would cut a promo. He was unbelievable on the mic. He had the professional background, professional sports background that obviously just gives you like instant credibility. Got money to invest, the right attitude to like go after it. I was always a huge fan of him. Like I was like, we should keep him at all costs, but he was destined to be on his own. That's a guy that doesn't really need a umbrella to be under.
How do you think it's going to work out at ESPN for him?
I think
does that seem like a long-term fit?
I don't see why not. Pat was never like a edgy, inflammatory type of guy. So when people were like, oh, he's censored, I'm like, that show's always been like a bunch of buddies talking about football and, you know, goofing around. It's not like it's a sex show. It's not like they talk about politics. It's not like, you know, they're taking a stance on social issues. It's always been, you know, wrestling, football, and like just, you know, the guys being the guys. So maybe cleans up his language a little bit. Maybe there's a couple topics he can't touch. But for the most part, I would imagine the Pat McAfee show stays the Pat McAfee show, and it's just now broadcast on the mothership.
What has the decision to hire Erica meant for Barstool?
Erica brought a lot of organization and like teamwork and all that to a very chaotic circus, you know? We were never going to like, Dave is obviously, as we've seen, it turned into a great businessman. And I think he always had it in him, but there was certainly a time where, you know, he was just more focused on being funny and doing dumb shit out there, getting filmed and being on camera. And I don't think there was ever going to be a world where we, the people who are making it all, we're in the boardrooms and on the conference calls and making the connections and all that. And so I don't think we ever would have sold once or twice or got it back without someone like her at the helm. So I'm very indebted to her. She's done a lot for me professionally and financially and personally. And so she was I'm very, very happy she came through our lives.
Do you have much interaction with Dave? Obviously, he was doing more of the gambling stuff the last couple of years and things like that.
I've talked to Dave the last couple of weeks, probably more than I've talked to him the last few years.
Oh, wow.
Because it was always, you know, he's always said, like, him and Dan do a lot of stuff together. It was always like the three of us. And then when gambling and even before Penn, it was just like those two gamble. So they're always talking about their bets and they're always doing their content together. So they naturally kind of paired off. And I think we're all cool professionally, but it's not like we hang out with each other every day. So it was kind of like if we're not seeing each other at work and doing content together, we're really not in each other's day-to-day lives. I don't know if you can tell, but Dave is not really the type to be like checking in on you and your kids and like keeping up with small talk. So it was always just like when we get together, we make good content and we always there's always like a mutual respect, but we never really talked much. And then I think this whole thing is just – kind of, it's been like a little time machine back to the days when we were all like in contact and talking and, you know, just sharing news and it all impacts everybody now and all that. So been a lot more texting and chatter and talk in the last couple of weeks than in the last couple of years.
What year did you join Barstool?
2009.
And did you you had the blog you mentioned that was For Sure Not?
Yeah.
Did you sell it or did you just end it?
I just said it was so when I started blogging, it was called For Sure Not, which is just like a silly phrase that me and like my best friends that guys I've known since I was in like first grade, we would always just say For Sure Not or FSN. And it kind of became this lingo and language and this catchphrase. And so when I was reading Barstool, I started that. The plan was me and my two buddies to start a website and just kind of fuck around. And they kind of fell off because as I've learned doing content, like you have to really, really commit to it. So I was just doing it for fun. But I started to get like, I sent it to like my close friends and they were reading it, but of course, cause they're like your friends and family, but all of a sudden, like their friends started to read it and then friends of friends started to read it. And I was like, you know, there actually might be something here, but I think I got to like 1,000 viewers a day. It was, it was never making any money, but right when Dave said, I'm looking for a New York City writer. And at the time, like I said, I had a good job, I had benefits, I was not really ready to leave, but my friends were like, you gotta try this. And when I sent it to him, he was like, actually, somebody's already sent me this. I've like kind of had my eye on this. Somebody already recommended it. I don't know if that was a friend or a reader or what, but then it became very real all of a sudden. So that was, you know, I'd started it in like 08 and then I wrote it through 07, through 09. And then August, actually, probably like right around now, maybe like even to the day almost, it would be my, 14
anniversary. Yeah.
So in August, he was like, I narrowed it down to you and one other guy. I can't decide between you two. but how about you keep your job and split the money and split the writing, which was the perfect scenario for me because I wasn't really ready to give up that paycheck and those benefits and all that. So now I just got extra cash. I get to do what I love on a much higher level. And then it allowed me to kind of transition out of the corporate world and into the blogging world. Because by the time I went full time, it was like a, you know, at the time we didn't know if it was going to last, if it was going to work. Dave was kind of like, this is an experiment. And if it takes off, good. And if it fails, I'll just bring it back to Boston.
Right.
So it was still like a risk, but it had grown to the point that I was like, I'm pretty sure this is going to stick around long enough that I can at least, you know, make a livable salary in New York and write about sports and silly shit for a living. So, 14 years. Wow. It's crazy.
So I was never a huge Barstool fan, and it wasn't really for any other reason than I was a big radio fan first. WFAN was always my primary source of content consumption. The first time I ever heard of you was when you were on Boomer and Carton.
It was huge for me.
Yeah, I don't remember what year that was, but I think it was after Boomer's daughter Sydney was on the Barstool website, and then
I forgot. Yes. First of all, I have to give an enormous thank you to Boomer and Carton, but specifically Craig, because he was always very forward thinking. You know, radio can be a very like archaic world. And he was always like blogs of the future, podcasts of the future. He followed me on Twitter. If they got a story from us, they would always credit us. Dukes, Boomer, Eddie Scazzeri, all those guys. Mikey Recco, all of them. But the first time I went on, we had just posted Sydney, who's a very beautiful girl. And at the time she was at Boston College. And one of the things we did at Barstool was we would post attractive college girls who wanted to like basically do like some amateur modeling. And Boomer was, you know, giving me the business over it. And I remember it was like all jokes, but you know, not, because it's like still like, you're talking to this girl's father, and we were talking about how she's very pretty, and Boomer is, you know, this behemoth of a man. And I was like, nice to meet you, Mr. Esiason. How are you, Mr. Esiason? So, but I grew up the same way, man. You know, Mike and the Dog and the morning show was, you know, and Evan and Joe were like part of my literal life every day. So when I got to call in for the first time, you know, as like a guest, not as a caller, and then get on their show. And then the same thing once Gio took over, he was great to me too. So that to me was probably, you know, one of my first and biggest like, hallmarks and milestones was like getting the WFAN seal of approval.
I feel like it wouldn't be a great fit for you, but have you ever been approached about doing more work there, a job there? Cause I know you've filled in even, I think you co-hosted with Evan a couple of times a few years back.
Especially with
all the changes that have gone on recently, did they ever approach you to see if you had any interest?
No, I know when there was the shakeup when Craig left, some people put out like some odds, and I think I was on the list. But no, there was never anything formal. Never talked to them. I actually think it would be a good fit. If I could like script it all out, I would love to do Barstool, you know, probably forever. But if there was a world where when I'm older and I'm, you know, like I said, continue to age appropriately, and there's certain topics I don't want to talk about anymore and certain things in my life I don't do anymore. If I could kind of like have my last leg of my career be like, I just talk about the Mets on WFAN and take calls with the, you know, the bozos around the city all day. I think that would be a fun, you know, fun way to wrap it up. Like I started as a fan and then one day get to be on the fan to wrap it up. So it would be different, obviously.
And I think the reason why I don't think it would be a good fit is it seems like it's something that would get boring or monotonous for you.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why I view it more as like something I would do towards the end or once I've. But you know what? I say that it's like sometimes I think, you know, radio could use a shakeup, and it's like if WFAN, you know, if it was a little more like Barstool, because our audience it's the same, you know? And yes, when people tune into the fan, they want to talk about like, you know, why did Buck take him out in the seventh inning? And why did he throw a curveball on the 2-1 count? Like very, you know, sports minutia. But also, Craig kind of proved it when he started to do more pop culture and entertainment and the other side of sports. Like, people love that too. So I wonder if there's a world where we kind of – I change a little to fit their mold and they change a little bit to fit my mold, and it could be something cool and new. But, you know, that's also – who knows? That's
yeah. Were you surprised to see that Craig left for his Fox Sports show?
No, the only reason I say no is because, like, he couldn't – he was working, like – I mean, he was working like 20 hours a day. It was just, it was inhumane. I was very impressed and very, it was remarkable what he did, because as somebody who's gone through, you know, some shitty public shaming stuff, I feel like he knew that was like, he got a second chance and it was, you know, well, am I going to get one? Am I not? And then when he did get it, he made the most of it. You know, he didn't turn a single thing down. He did every single job he could, radio, TV, multiple networks, and, you know, made his way back to the top. So I wouldn't have been surprised if he stayed at WFAN. I'm not surprised that he left, but something had to give with doing all of the shows all the time. It's just too many hours in a day.
And I'm going to guess that you're not locked into Mike Francesa's podcast every single week, but how much do you love when you still see like a ridiculous Mike Francesa clip or headline that just gets put out on Twitter, which still happens like every couple of weeks?
Well, I don't want to jinx it, knock on wood, because it hasn't happened yet, but I think I'm going to get my first sit down with Mike coming up this summer.
Oh, nice.
And that will be a big career achievement for me. And I hope we can, you know, be honest and talk about some of the silly stuff that, you know, surrounded his career. And I mean, to me, he's number one. He's the greatest. And he was good to me too, man. I mean, we sold a shirt of his and he was kind enough to hold it up on the air. And I think he referred to me as the Boston kid, which everyone got a kick out of. And, you know, we sold some shirts and he's always been very, supportive of it, and I think he likes Dave. They have the horse riding racing connection. So I love it, man. I wish it could have gone on forever. I wish those if Dog and Mike could somehow reunite and like if and they could capture what they used to have, I wish those two could just like do it forever. I need like AI to recreate Mike and the Dog and we could just live it forever, because that's something I'll never be recreated.
And then the last thing, are you stunned by the Mets this season?
Brother, I mean, you know, me and Frank the Tank go head to head here. I used to be like the most negative Mets fan in the world until Frank came in with a whole new brand of negativity that I've never even encountered. And I still don't even give Frank the credit, because to say like you saw this coming,
right?
Even with the Mets history. And even I know, like, you know, the Mets are going to Met and LOL Mets, and like everything seems to go bad. Even with that reputation, the players we brought in, the year we had last year.
Right, 101 wins last season.
And now, don't get me wrong, I was wrecked by the end of last year.
Yeah.
I a grown-ass man, I literally cried. I put my soul into that team, and I realized – That was special. That's why I was screaming all year long at the people who were being negative about that team. Because I was like, you're missing the greatness that we never get to experience.
Yeah.
And next year, it ain't going to be here, because we're going to have some injuries and we're going to have some regression. And not everyone's going to have a career year. And what do you know? Lo and behold, all of those things happened. But even with that, I was thinking like, we'll be a wild card. Hopefully we have a Phillies type of run. But we'll be in the mix. I guess, you know, we could have foreseen two old pitchers struggling. And Verlander turned it around, but like early on struggled. I guess you could say, hey, you built a rotation around ancient guys and they didn't pitch well. But I don't know, man. That was just like everything that could go wrong. And you know what? It's the WBC. It's the World Baseball Classic's fault. We were cursed from the jump. The minute that Diaz broke his leg, it was just bad juju. If there was no WBC this year, I will take it to my grave that we would have had another good season. But man, that was just I'm happy what they did though. I think, you know, you're either winning or you're losing, and they were losing. And I think that they got a lot of good prospects. I think more so I mean, how many times with the Wilpons do we see, let's try to salvage a sinking ship and go get an aging veteran with has a flashy name and sell some tickets? I'd rather tear it down. And you know,
or with the Wilpons, it would have been trading them, but not eating any of their salary and then getting nobody back in return. So at least Cohen was willing to pay a chunk of the salary of Verlander and Scherzer, and then you hope that you get good prospects back.
And I think it would to do a proper rebuild, I think you have to do it a little bit early. If you're rebuilding when it's too late, you're not going to get anything. When you rebuild early, that's when you're getting, you know, something in return. So it's got to hurt a little bit. If it doesn't hurt, you're not going to get anything in the future. So I think that you're doing it right. I will say I think it should stop with Pete, though. I don't think 40 home run guys grow on trees, and I think that they're kind of painting him that way. At least when I say they, you know, the people online who are chattering for it, I think he should be part of the plans, unless you could get like some major haul. But for a team that's always pretty devoid of power, a guy that you can pencil in for like 40 to 50 home runs, I don't care what he bats, you know?
Yeah. Every single time that the Mets seem like they're building something that like, all right, this is going to last for at least three or four seasons where you know that they're going to be in the playoffs every year, you know, after 1 year, it just breaks down. And I just can't figure out why they don't have that. They're unable to have that infrastructure to build anything for any sort of long-term success.
That is what should have been the tip off. Like we always make the playoffs 1 year and then we're gone.
Right.
It, you know, 99 in 2000. And then I don't really count the play-in game. So it's basically been, you know, we've only made the playoffs once and then we disappear. I always joke with Clem on our Mets podcast. We got to believe we call them the cicadas. They disappear for 7 years and then they come back and they're loud and they do well and then they disappear. But I think that we're in the process of building that. I think this is about 2006 too. I think in 06, the Mets got too good, too fast. I think in 05, they were building. And I think had they won like 90 games the next year, it would have been like, let's just keep going. But all of a sudden, you have 97 games and it's like, oh, we're a World Series contender. We're only one piece away. Let's just add Moises Alou or K-Rod. Right. And it's like, you actually needed to add a few guys and let a few guys develop. And I think the same thing happened here. I think 22 was so lightning in a bottle that, you know, was never going to repeat. But I think, you know, if they go get their guy Stearns and Steve keeps pouring in the money and the analytics, like he's just not going to, it's his play toy. He's too rich and too into it that it will eventually become that machine. But man, it really does make you tip your cap to the Dodgers of the world. And unfortunately the Braves of the world, like they just do it every goddamn year. I don't know how, cause we can't even do it twice, but they can do it every year. It's crazy.
Kevin, you were great. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
You got it, bro. Thanks a lot.
That is Kevin Clancy. This is the Awful Announcing podcast, and we have Awful Announcing's Andrew Buchholz up next to discuss Kevin Brown and the Baltimore Orioles. Alrighty, welcome to part two of this week's Awful Announcing podcast, where we are joined by Awful Announcing's Andrew Buchholz, who was at the helm of our breaking news report last week that Baltimore Orioles play-by-play voice Kevin Brown was removed from the booth for citing the team's recently improved record against the Tampa Bay Rays. And Brown has since returned to the broadcast, but everything that went down last week with him and the Orioles was bizarre, to say the least. But Andrew, first of all, great job on the story. Second, what was your initial reaction when you were alerted to this being a potential story with Brown? And then your reaction when you heard the audio that was in question?
Yeah, thank you, Brandon. I should point out that this wasn't just me. This story was with the help of my colleagues, Ben Koo and Sean Keeley. And it was a really remarkable story. My reaction was the same as many people when they first saw the clipping question that we found of, I can't believe he was pulled for something as seemingly innocuous as this. There must be more to this story. But we collaboratively dug and dug and dug and got confirmation from multiple sources that this was, in fact, what the issue was, that there were issues on the team's side with Kevin Brown doing something as innocuous as pointing out that the Orioles are better, were significantly better this year than they had been the previous years against the Rays.
Were you surprised how quickly this story took off? Like, have you ever had another story that reached this far, this fast? I mean, Awful Announcing was like, we weren't just getting credit and attention on social media. The site was being credited and mentioned by ESPN, CNN, Fox News. It was all over the place.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a nice thing with Awful Announcing is we do have this history and we do have this reputation and a tradition of providing some good reporting when circumstances call for it. I've been with the site since 2012, and we've done a lot of cool things over that span of time. The one that stands out to me as maybe the most comparable to this was the Bishop Sycamore situation a couple of years ago. And Ben also worked with me on that, and as did several of our other colleagues. And we were really first on a lot of the key information coming out about that so-called fake high school and what was actually going on there. But what stood out with the reaction here was that it wasn't just news media really covering it. What really impressed me and stood out to me was how this resonated within the announcing community, especially within the play-by-play community. And so many MLB broadcasters chimed in support of Kevin Brown and in criticism of the Orioles. And to me, that's notable to see, especially given that most of them are working for teams as well. So it could be a little hard for them to offer some criticism. But I think a lot of them did a great job of standing up for play-by-play here and for the importance of presenting facts fairly and with criticism when warranted.
Obviously, this was tweeted about before we got to it, the story about Brown. But what was kind of your process of then vetting the story before going live with it, especially because you said you had that similar reaction to what everybody else kind of had when they watched this and said, no, like there has to be more.
Yeah, absolutely. So there were a bunch of tweets wondering why Brown was off the air. Then there was one tweet suggesting it was over this and citing sources. Interestingly enough, after that got some further confirmation from Roy Firestone, of all people, the former ESPN broadcaster, who's a really well-known and renowned name. But then even with that, we didn't want to go with this until we had independently confirmed it. And so that led to a lot of further reporting, further reaching out on our end until we had it at a place where we had multiple sources all confirming that this was what was in question. And it's a tricky situation. It's something you very much don't want to report on unless you're absolutely sure of what happened. But we are very confident in our reporting and trust that it has held up here.
Do you think it's fair to label this type of treatment of their broadcasters as a pattern by the Baltimore Orioles?
There are certainly a lot of instances of the Baltimore Orioles having interesting controversies with their announcers, and those controversies have sometimes led to their exits. One of the things I thought was the best in follow-up to this was not from us. It was from Andrew Baggerly of The Athletic, who talked to John Miller. And John Miller very famously had that fallout with the Orioles in the late 90s that led to him leaving and becoming the broadcaster of the San Francisco Giants. And Miller's comments really stood out to me for showing not just how this happened, but then also, in his opinion at least, that what Peter Angelos, the owner, who was very hands-on involved at that time, less so now, but how Angelos's public comments were so different from what John Miller's agent was told. And I think that story was really interesting and really showed off a bit maybe of some similar things here. And then over the last few years, there have been other very weird things with the Orioles. There have been very weird firings of people. There have been very weird assignments and non-assignments. So they're a team where the local broadcasters certainly have been under some scrutiny, it seems, from the team, and there's been some controversy about that.
At what point do broadcasters kind of like hesitate to work for the Orioles, or are these jobs just too precious and prized for that to ever even happen?
Yeah, I think the thing is, this is always going to be one of a very limited number of top tier jobs. Baseball broadcasting is a great job, and there are so many people who want to do it at the top level. And we should point out, too, that despite this history and despite these controversies, the Orioles have been able to get great talents. In addition to Kevin Brown, they've got just a great range of people on radio and TV. So clearly that hasn't stopped anyone. It may have stopped some people from pursuing those jobs, but they've been able to find great broadcasters. The only question is if they can keep them.
As the immediate response to the video had a lot of people on social media, like we had already discussed, just kind of saying like there has to be more. This can't be it. Was there any sense of like, obviously you vetted the story, you dug into it, but was there any sense of almost like vindication as other outlets started to confirm the report? The Athletic came out and confirmed it. Andrew Marchand then confirmed it. Did you feel any sort of sense of vindication, or did you not even really need that?
Well, I don't know that it was needed. We were very confident in our story, but it's always nice to see that. And it's always nice to see other people both independently report and check for themselves. Because if we do have it wrong, we want to be transparent about that and correct it. In this case, they did their own checking and they came up with this very similar answers to what we found. And I also appreciate how well they cited us on this, because that hasn't always been the case.
So Brown returned to the booth for the Orioles on last Friday, and during the afternoon prior to going back to the broadcast booth, he tweeted out a statement saying his relationship with the team had been mischaracterized. He did not deny or refute any of the reporting, however, which I think is an important thing to note. But what was that sort of statement? Was it predictable in your mind?
I don't know that it was predictable. I don't know that I knew how this was going to pan out in the end. There are a number of different ways this could have gone, and it could have continued to be a messy public fight. There were ways that maybe he never wound up calling the Orioles again. This was certainly one of the outcomes that could have happened, though, and it's something we do see a fair bit where not just in broadcasting, but in team front offices and coaching moves and so on, where there may be a lot of drama behind the scenes, a lot of things that do get reported. And then the public facing statement is, no, everything's all fine here. So I think that you're quite right. It's important to consider what that statement does not say. And it's important to consider the reactions to that statement from other people. I really appreciate Michael Kay's reaction to that statement. But I think that statement does not refute what we reported on.
Yeah. And Michael Kay had called it a hostage tape. That's what he said the statement read and sounded like. This is purely speculative, but if you had to guess, is Brown in the broadcast booth for the Orioles next season?
It's a good question, and I don't know. I think that depends. I mean, I don't personally know the status of his contract.
Even if
his contract does go beyond this year, I think there's absolutely a chance he moves on somewhere else. I think what this situation has really shown is how good of a broadcaster Kevin Brown is, how much respect he has from peers in the industry and from players and from a lot of people. And I think Kevin Brown is likely to be broadcasting at the top level for quite a while. Whether that's with the Orioles or not, we'll see. But again, there are only those 30 top MLB teams. So it's, and a lot of them are set and have been set for a long time. So it's not that there are just a ton of places he could immediately and obviously jump to.
Right. I think this is me almost just kind of playing like fantasy sports with broadcasters, ignoring the reality of all the situations. But I think this is a great opportunity for Fox to try to make Brown the next voice of Major League Baseball. And Joe Davis is great. Brian Anderson is great with TBS. But without Joe Buck in October, I think baseball has lost some star power. I don't think Bob Costas is really in line to fill that void in this stage of his career, but Brown is now very well known around the country. Mm-hmm. He is young. He's really, really good at his job. I think Fox and baseball can sort of try to capitalize on this newfound celebrity and have Brown become the voice of the World Series for the next 20 years or so. Is that too big of a reach for me to think that after all of this just went down?
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I think there certainly are ways Brown could wind up with more of a national role. I think Joe Davis is relatively well established at Fox. I don't know that number one slot is becoming open, but I think there are certainly opportunities, whether at Fox or at other networks carrying MLB nationally. And it's worth noting, too, there's more and more of that these days now that you have MLB on Apple and Peacock, and those broadcasting crews have been a little bit in flux. So there certainly could be some national roles and larger national roles ahead for him. The thing that I think is cool about this, you mentioned how young Brown is, and experience in broadcasting is great. And there are a lot of experienced broadcasters who do a very good job. But I think sometimes at the national level in particular, some executives maybe put too much focus on experience, and they're not willing to really give shots to that young of a name. It can work out spectacularly when they do, though. I mean, that's what we saw with Joe Buck. Joe Buck certainly got better over time, but he got those first opportunities at a very young age. And so I think hopefully maybe something that can come out of the Kevin Brown situation is that executives can take a look and go beyond just the people who have been doing this at the top level for decades and decades and look at some of the real young talent that's out there.
Andrew, great stuff. Thanks. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Brandon.
That is Andrew Buchholz. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Please rate and subscribe to this podcast. Please also subscribe to Awful Announcing's YouTube page. But regardless of how you consume Awful Announcing and the Awful Announcing Podcast, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com. And follow us at Awful Announcing.